From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. There's a total solar eclipse somewhere on Earth about every 18 months, but most of them are not nearly as accessible as the one many Illinoisans will be experiencing this afternoon. The next total solar eclipse visible across the continental U.S. is not for another 21 years, according to NASA. And if you want to see one in Illinois, I hope you're into healthy living, because that won't happen until September 14th, 2099. The forecast is looking good in the path of totality across southern Illinois, at least as of this morning, with mostly sunny skies and temperatures in the mid-70s. Governor Pritzker is scheduled to be in Carbondale at Southern Illinois University's Saluki Stadium for the eclipse this afternoon. He'll join thousands of other people, including our producer, Jose Zepeda. I'll be elsewhere in Southern Illinois, as will other members of the 21st Show and Illinois Public Media teams. We'll have a recap on tomorrow's program. Today, we're going to hear from David Barron, a diehard umbraphile and eclipse chaser who's found, as he puts it, magic in the shade of the moon. Since his first experience of totality in Aruba, 1998, he's worked hard to see as many subsequent eclipses as he can. Barron was a longtime science reporter for NPR. Now he's an author, best known for the book American Eclipse, A Nation's Epic Race to Catch the Shadow of the Moon and Win the Glory of the World. The book's about the total eclipse that crossed America late in the afternoon of July 28, 1878. He first published it for The Last North American Eclipse in 2017, and it's just come out this year in a new edition. In order to accommodate both Barron's and my travel plans to see the eclipse, we taped this conversation in late March. David Barron, welcome to The 21st Show. Thank you for making the time to speak with us.
Thanks, Brian. Happy to be here.
Take us back to Aruba, February 1998. What were you expecting to get out of your first eclipse?
Well, I mean, I thought it would be something to intellectually interesting. You know, I mean, I'm a science writer. I had interviewed an astronomer a few years before who told me how wonderful a total eclipse was and encouraged me to go see one, which is why I was in Aruba. But still, you know, I figured, okay, it would be beautiful. What I didn't expect is it would change my life. I mean, it would be the most profound thing I'd ever witnessed in nature. And would get me hooked.
You describe it in almost religious terms at points in the book. And I don't know if you're a religious person, if I hope that's not too personal, but talk about that.
Yeah, no, I'm happy for you to ask. I am definitely not a religious person. And that's part of what made it so surprising to me is I'm a very logical person. I didn't really grow up religious. I don't tend to think that there's some higher power, at least some kind of conscious higher power that runs things. But my goodness, when the sun suddenly went away in the middle of the day at this total eclipse in Aruba in 1998, and I looked into the sky and I saw a sky like none I'd ever seen before. It was beautiful and it was so moving because I understood that I was looking at the solar system. I mean, that's the amazing thing about a total eclipse. It's not really what's hidden that's important, but what's revealed, because as soon as the moon completely blocks the face of the sun, the blue sky drops away. And the blue sky on any typical day is a curtain that keeps us from seeing what's overhead. And suddenly that curtain fell away, and here I was looking into space, seeing the sun like I'd never seen it before, because I could see the sun's outer atmosphere, which is glorious, and I could see the planets at the same time. So I felt like I had left Earth. I was on some other planet, and it like all made sense to me. I understood in a visceral way that I am floating through space. I am on a piece of rock floating through space. I am at the mercy of forces so unimaginably huge that I am insignificant. And yet I am part of all of that. So it was both humbling and really kind of empowering, which is exactly, I think, what a lot of people get from traditional religion. That's what I get from total eclipses.
Yeah, that sort of galactic connection, one's place as a very insignificant speck in this vast universe. Let's talk about the patterns of eclipses. You covered this a little in the book, 6,585 and one-third days. And yet, somewhere, what is it, every 18 months this happens on Earth. Talk about how rare these events are.
Well, so depending on how you look at them, they're either very rare or they're not all that rare. So let me explain what I mean. Any given point on Earth will see a total solar eclipse on average every 400 years. In fact, where I live in Boulder, Colorado, I looked into it. The next total solar eclipse that will go over my house won't be until July 22nd, 2772, more than 700 years from now. So for a total solar eclipse to come to you is exceptionally rare. For it to happen in your lifetime is against the odds. However, they do occur about once every 18 months somewhere on Earth. So if you're willing to travel to them, you could see a number in your lifetime, which is now what I do. Now, that number that you gave about over 6,000 days, that's called the Saros cycle. So it's actually every 18 years plus 10 or 11 days, and it depends on whether how many leap years there are, a given eclipse will return to Earth. And that's true both of solar eclipses and lunar eclipses. So after 18 years plus 10 or 11 days, basically the Earth, the Moon, and the Sun are almost lined up exactly the same way they were before. And you will get, in essence, the same eclipse, but it will fall on a different part of the Earth. It's hard to explain without showing visuals, but eclipse paths they sort of snake across the globe, and each eclipse path has its own shape. But after 18 years, you'll see a total eclipse will return, and it will have the same shape. It's just painted on a different part of the globe. So there really are these cycles, but for us just living our lives, they can seem sort of random in terms of where they happen to occur on the Earth.
And it's often over the ocean or the Arctic or the Antarctic or some remote place that's really hard to get to.
Precisely. Yeah. So the Earth is mostly ocean. So most eclipse paths go over ocean. So to have a total eclipse come to where you are is rare. And even for it to be someplace convenient to get to is not the norm. I mean, I've now seen 8 total solar eclipses on 5 continents. I was supposed to see one in Antarctica a few years ago, but that got canceled due to COVID, unfortunately. But last April, there was a total eclipse that went over one tiny little bit of Australia, way far northwestern Australia. There was one tiny town called Exmouth that was in the path. So crazy eclipse chasers who wanted to see it went there. And that total eclipse lasted all of 56 seconds. But I went all the way there because that's where I had to go to see it, and it was worth it.
We're actually, later in this program, we'll be talking to a professor from Southern Illinois University in Carbondale who traveled with some students to that very eclipse in Australia.
That's probably Bob Baer.
It's Corey Brevik, actually.
I think I may have met up with him as well. Yeah, I met up with the group from SIU in Exmouth. Again, that's where you had to be.
We've been asking listeners about their eclipse plans. We've been collecting emails and voicemails. Let's listen to one.
Hi, my name's Ronnie, and I live in Carbondale, Illinois. We were lucky enough to observe the most recent eclipse from our backyard. In fact, we were able to swim in the pond and enjoy the totality of the event. We're hopeful that we will have great clear skies and see it again from our backyard. We love your show. Have a good day.
Thank you for that, Ronnie. David, it's pretty rare that an eclipse will happen over the same city, the same region, twice in such short succession like that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's like winning Powerball twice. It is remarkable, but obviously that will happen because these paths snake. They're very narrow, usually about 100 miles wide, but they can go for thousands of miles. So if one occurs on Earth about every 18 months. So if you start painting these stripes across the globe, they will before too long, a couple of them will cross. And wherever they cross, that's where you have the lucky people who get to see 2 total eclipses in a short amount of time.
Without even booking a hotel room. Yeah, all right. You do a beautiful job midway through the book, I guess almost toward the end of the book, describing the run-up to an eclipse, right? Maybe until 15 minutes before totality, you might not even notice anything's happening if you aren't expecting it. Can you talk us through what happens as the sun really begins to be blocked by the moon?
Well, so to start with the partial phase, so a total eclipse begins as a partial eclipse as the moon slowly makes its way across the sun. And there's always a lot of excitement as the partial eclipse is about to begin and everyone's looking through their eclipse glasses because you can't look with the naked eye without harming your vision. But looking through eclipse glasses, everyone's trying to see who could be the first to spot that tiny little flattening or dent in the side of the sun that is the moon. That's, you can't see the moon, but that's what's starting to cover the sun. And so there's a flurry of excitement at the beginning of the partial eclipse. And then, well, it gets kind of boring because it takes a while, more than an hour, for the moon to move completely over the sun. And people are, you know, looking for things to do. And if this is your first total eclipse, you might even be thinking, was it really worth it? It's like watching the grass grow. But then about 15 minutes before the total eclipse, weird things do start to happen. You'll notice that the temperature is dropping. You may start to notice that birds are acting strange. Shadows are becoming very odd. So there are two things about that. One is if you look under a tree where the light's speckling the ground, those speckles will be little crescents because the spaces between the leaves or the branches are acting as pinhole projectors. And you're actually seeing the image of the crescent sun on the ground. So that's cool. But also, as the sun shrinks, shadows grow sharper. You know, on a typical day, shadows have very fuzzy edges. But as a partial eclipse ends up moving toward a total eclipse, shadows become weirdly sharp. Colors start to change. In fact, it will seem as if the color is draining from the landscape. And you'll notice that before you notice it getting dimmer. It is getting dimmer, but our eyes are very good at adjusting. So for much of the partial eclipse, it'll seem just as bright as any other day. It isn't, but it'll seem like it is. And it's really only in those last 5 minutes or so that it really gets weird. So now you may see lights coming on. You know, street lights might come on, or you might see, security lights. So clearly it's gotten dark enough for you to see those. About a minute and a half before totality, you may see strange ripples of light dance across the ground. They're called shadow bands. You don't always see them.
Visible wind, but, you described this as in the book.
Yeah, they've been called visible wind. And in fact, what you're seeing are, it's the currents of hot and cold air in the atmosphere that's bending the light as it's coming in from the sun.
I'm going to pause there because I don't remember that in Illinois, at least back in 2017. Is that something you've experienced on your
various adventures? It wasn't until my fifth total eclipse okay. that I finally saw shadow bands. And there are two things going on. One is you need to have the conditions just right. Secondly, you have to look for them because most everyone is looking in the sky because you're waiting for the total eclipse to begin. Unless you look for them, you're not going to see them. But when I was in Chile in 2019, right after totality, and that's become my habit, right after the total eclipse, when the sun comes back out and you can't look at you're not going to see the solar corona anymore, I turn around and look at the ground and I look for shadow bands. And in 2019, I was on a beach in Chile and behind me were these 13-story condo buildings, just sheer white. And they were just rippling. I mean, it looked like I was at the bottom of a swimming pool with these ripples of light. It was just magical. So definitely when totality is over, look for the shadow bands. But again, you don't always see them.
Yeah.
And then the darkness comes on with just shocking rapidity. I mean, it comes on so fast. It's like someone's turned out the lights. And it doesn't get as dark as midnight. Some people think it's going to be, you know, dark as night, sky full of stars. It's not that dark. It's sort of like twilight 40 minutes after sunset. But it's just magical because you have that twilight effect overhead. But on the horizon, it's like sunset, you know, an orange horizon all around you, 360 degrees. So it's like you've just suddenly plunged into some alternate reality.
I have tape from last time, or when I experienced this, the first and only time I've experienced this, and you hear crickets coming out. As you mentioned, you can see the barn lights turning on. It really does feel like night. The animals are confused, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. So insects will definitely react. Birds will definitely react. In my experience, dogs couldn't care less. I mean, I was with some dogs in Australia last year, They were chewing on sticks as the partial eclipse continued. They were chewing on sticks during the totality. I mean, they didn't behave any differently. But birds, you may see bats come out. Flowers that will normally close up at night will start to close. So there are definitely living beings that will react to this weird night.
The other thing I would say is if you have the chance to see it, I know a lot of people will be gathering in a stadium at the on the Southern Illinois University campus, but I happened to go and I'm hoping to go again to an churchyard that had an open farm field behind it. And you can actually see the path, right, of the light or the shadow, the light and shadow moving across the landscape quickly.
Yeah. So I advise people, I mean, there are lots of wonderful ways to see a total eclipse, whether it's with a huge crowd or by yourself in a city, in a rural area. But do find a place where you have an expansive view of the sky, because you're not just going to be looking at the solar corona itself, basically what you'll see of the sun, but there will be planets in the sky. Some will be low on the horizon. There's that, again, that 360 degree sunset effect. So if you could be someplace on a rooftop, in a big open field, on a lake shore, where you can see as much of the horizon as possible, that'll really help you to take in the full experience. And you may, in fact, also see literally the moon's shadow as it races in at 2,000 miles an hour.
All right, we need to take a break. More from David Barron, author of American Eclipse, when we return. This is The 21st Show. Stay with us. It's The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are about 2.5 hours away from totality, the great American eclipse across southern Illinois. Today on the program, we're listening to an interview I recorded a couple of weeks ago with David Barron, author of a book about another great American eclipse. It's called American Eclipse, A Nation's Epic Race to Catch the Shadow of the Moon and Win the Glory of the World. It's about the total eclipse that crossed America on the afternoon of July 28th, 1878. Talk about how you came to write this book. It was a long research project.
This was almost a 20-year project. So as we discussed earlier, I saw my first total eclipse in 1998, and it really was a life-changing experience. I mean, I became an eclipse chaser. And as a science writer, I decided I wanted to write about this. I thought I should write a book to try to bring the excitement of total solar eclipses to a general public. But 1998, when I first had the idea, I realized there wouldn't be a total solar eclipse in the United States until 2017. And then, of course, there'd be one 7 years later. So I figured I wanted a book to come out for the eclipses of 2017 and 2024. And so that gave me a long time to figure out what I wanted to do. And in my type of science writing, I don't write technical books. I write for a general public. And I find the best way to get people excited about science is just to tell good stories. If you can find a good human tale that happens to be about science, people will be interested in the story. And along the way, you can, when they're not paying attention, you can educate them a little bit. So I wanted to find just a good story about eclipses. And it became evident pretty quickly that the best stories about eclipses are not from today, but from the 19th century. Because that's when total eclipses were not just fascinating spectacles to gawk at, but they were keenly important for science. Back then, astronomers were just starting to unravel the mysteries of the sun. What is this great ball of fire in the sky? What fuels it? What is it made of? And there were certain studies of the sun that could be done only during a total eclipse, something that happens once every year and a half on average. It's usually someplace very hard to get to. Will last all of 3 minutes, but it was so important that astronomers would put together these grand expeditions to the far corners of the Earth to sit in the path of the moon's shadow with their equipment and frantically conduct observations in those 3 minutes of midday darkness. And I figured somewhere in there, there's got to be a good story. And after researching a bunch of these eclipses, it all came together just with everything that I was looking for was in the eclipse of 1878, July 29th of 1878.
So there had already been, as you mentioned, these European expeditions. They had figured out that the sun's the sort of corona was hydrogen gas. This helium was discovered there decades before it was found on Earth. What were the scientific goals of the groups that went to Colorado and Wyoming for the 1878 eclipse?
Right. So the path of the 1878 eclipse, as you said, it went across the western United States. So if you see it, it actually went right down the spine of the Rockies, across the western frontier from Montana Territory down to Texas. And this was the Wild West. I mean, the area was just being settled. And it was the Gilded Age in the East. And you had all of these Gilded Age scientists coming out to this rough and tumble part of the country for this event that would last 3 minutes. And there were a number of key questions that they were looking to answer. There still was the great mystery of the solar corona. So today we know the solar corona, which is only visible on Earth during a total eclipse. We know that it is the sun's outer atmosphere. But back then, no one knew what it was. It was just something that appeared as soon as the moon blocked the face of the sun. You saw this beautiful halo, this aura appear around it. And there had been a number of different theories. Maybe it was the atmosphere of the moon. It was backlit by the sun. Maybe it was just some kind of phenomenon of the sunlight being filtered through the Earth's atmosphere. Or if it was, in fact, part of the sun, what was it? Maybe it was meteors falling into the sun. Maybe it was like some kind of atmosphere, but no one knew. So just any additional information that could be collected about the solar corona was important. Its shape, what kind of light it was giving on. So that was important. But there was another key question that was being addressed in 1878 that could really only be addressed at a total solar eclipse. And that was whether there might be a planet or several planets closer to the sun than Mercury. And we all know Mercury is the first planet in our solar system going outward. But back then, there were good reasons to think that Mercury wasn't the first planet, because Mercury's orbit didn't fit with the calculations that astronomers made about the way it should behave. And it seemed to behave like there was some perturbing object, some mass between it and the sun, kind of dragging it along. And astronomers believed this so strongly, they gave the planet a name. It was called Vulcan. And you could look at some solar system charts from that era, and you'll see the first planet in the solar system is Vulcan. No one had ever seen it reliably. But if it's really that close to the sun, it's going to set with the sun. It won't be in the sky at night. You can't see it in the daytime because it's lost in the sun's glare. But during a total eclipse, when the moon blocks the bright sun and you can actually see what's right next to the sun, maybe they would find Vulcan. So looking for Vulcan was one of the key things the scientists were aiming to do in 1878.
You also detail the story of a woman named Maria Mitchell. What was she hoping to get out of the eclipse?
Yeah, she's my favorite character in the book. Mm. I say character, she was a real person, but I feel some ownership over these folks having written about them in a book. So Maria Mitchell was the best known female scientist in America in the 19th century. She first came to prominence in 1847 when she discovered a comet and got a gold medal from the King of Denmark. By 1878, she was teaching astronomy at Vassar College, which was then a new all-women's college in Poughkeepsie, New York. And this was a time when women's colleges were still new. Women's higher education was, frankly, considered a risky social experiment that people weren't sure if it was a good idea. And a few years beforehand, a prominent Boston doctor had written a sensational best-selling book that made the claim in all seriousness that higher education could ruin a girl's health, that if a young woman used her brain too much, that it would sap energy from other parts of her maturing body, including her reproductive organs, and turn her into a sterile masculine invalid. And this book set off a panic, this fear that what are we doing educating women, you know, in colleges? Well, Maria Mitchell thought this was crazy, but she encouraged young women to use their brains at Vassar. She saw no problem, but she needed to convince the American public that this book was fear-mongering. And in 1878, she did something truly remarkable. As groups of men were assembling eclipse expeditions to the Wild West with government support, both money and logistical support, Maria Mitchell, who had been excluded, put together on her own an all-female eclipse expedition to Denver. She brought along her sister Phoebe. She brought along some recent Vassar graduates, and they went to Denver to do science, but more than that, to demonstrate to the public that women could be smart and healthy and educated and feminine. There's this wonderful photograph of the Vassar College Eclipse Party that's in my book, of these women in Victorian dresses sitting daintily on chairs beside their telescopes on the plains of Colorado. And it just seems to sum up what Mariah Mitchell was trying to prove.
Even after a long, long train ride, which you have another writer saying could imperil their reproductive organs, quote, at the expense of her future usefulness.
Right. It says a lot about
it's a loaded phrase
views
right
on
there.
Women at that point. Yeah.
We should mention Thomas Edison is another thread in this book that we don't really have time to get into now. Well, I do think we know today there is no planet Vulcan, and we have women scientists. What are some of the outcomes that stick with you as you were telling this story?
Well, so the eclipse of 1878, one of the things that made it fascinating is when it occurred. So America was a young country, right? We had just recently turned 100 years old. We were becoming an economic power on the global scene. But when it came to intellectual affairs, the Europeans looked down their noses at us. I mean, Europe considered itself the center of Western culture. That's where great art and literature and music and science came from. Well, the United States wanted to show that it could compete in science. And here was this important scientific event in our own backyard. And that's one of the reasons why it became such a big deal. This was America's chance to shine. And that eclipse really was an important stepping stone toward the U.S. not too long after, by the 20th century, to really become an equal with Europe when it came to science, and then to become the clear global superpower. The people who went to that eclipse were some of those key people who built the institutions that enabled us to become this scientific power. And also, you know, one of the reasons the Europeans didn't really worry about America competing in science was because we were a democracy. They thought it required either a monarchy or still a country run by the elites. Of course, it's the elites who care about things like science, not the rabble. Not, you know, and here's America run by, you know, its own everybody. Why would a democracy care about science? Well, here was an event in 1878 that really got the public excited about science and about us competing in science. So that, again, is sort of like the moon landing in 1969. It was this big scientific event that had the American public rally around science.
I do also want to touch on, and you cover this as well in the book, the sort of apocalyptic strain in American life that was so prominent in the 1800s. You have this terrible story about Ephraim Miller and how he experiences the eclipse. Talk about that. How was this received among Christians who maybe were expecting the rapture, right? The second coming.
Yeah. Well, so what I was struck by when I was doing research for the book was how, for most people, the experience of the eclipse of 1878 was remarkably similar to the experience we're having today. The newspaper coverage was widespread. Folks knew when and where the eclipse was going to occur. They were excited about it. There were tours. People were getting eclipse glasses. We wouldn't consider them safe today, but they got their pieces of colored glass for looking at the sun during the partial eclipse. So for the most part, it was the same. But there was a part of Texas where a large number of folks clearly hadn't been reading the papers. They didn't know the eclipse was coming. They were just out in their farm fields on a hot July afternoon when all of a sudden it goes dark. And they look up in the sky and the sun is gone. And instead what they see is what looks like this heavenly crown. And in their worldview, it seemed pretty clear this was Christ returning. And in fact, as you said, there had been lots of predictions that Christ would return sometime soon. So they fell to their knees in prayer. They ran to church. And tragically, Ephraim Miller, this one young father, he decided he was not going to stick around for Judgment Day. He was going to get himself to the other side as quickly as he could, and he would take his young son with him. And he ran home in the darkness of the total eclipse, and with a hatchet, he killed his son, and then with a razor, he killed himself. And, I mean, this this was not that long ago. This was 1878. I mean, otherwise it was pretty modern times. But that is the emotional power of a total eclipse, particularly when you don't know it's coming.
Yeah. Matthew chapter 24, verse 29, shall the sun be darkened and the moon shall not give her light.
Right.
You have made, I don't know if you would say a life or certainly a passion in your life of chasing eclipses. Where will you go next? How do you plot these out?
Well, I'd like to see as many as I can for as long as I'm around. So, I mean, I only have limited choices in where I go because I've got to go where the moon's shadow is going. So 2026, there'll be a total eclipse that goes from Greenland to Iceland to Spain. I have yet to decide where I'm going for that. 2027, there's one going across North Africa, including right over Luxor, Egypt, which would be a great place to be. 2028, there's one that goes over Australia, and that one goes right over Sydney. And I might mention one thing, which is quite remarkably, one outcome of having written this book, which again, first came out in 2017, is I was contacted a few years ago by some Broadway theater producers who thought that there was a musical in this story. And at first I thought, that sounds a little crazy, but sure, let's see what happens. But the musical has been written, and it's a wonderful show. It's still a work in progress, but hopefully it will make its way to Broadway someday. Well, my great hope is that for the eclipse of 2028, which passes right over the Sydney Opera House, that we have a staging of American Eclipse the Musical for the eclipse. So that's still a few years off, but that's what I'm hoping. So I hope I'll be in Sydney in 2028 to see perhaps the first international production of the musical.
Amazing. I understand it's coming back to Illinois based on my own research, which take it with a grain of salt, but September 14th, 2099. I don't think I will be around for that one. So
well, but there will be a total eclipse coming to my home state of Colorado in 2045, August 12th of 2045. It won't go over Boulder where I live, but it goes just south of Denver. And in fact, it goes over Pikes Peak. And if I could have been anywhere in 1878 for that eclipse, it would have been on top of Pikes Peak at 14,000 feet. Because what the folks described who were up there was just astonishing. They could see the moon's shadow racing in at 2,000 miles an hour, coming in hundreds of miles away because they were so high, as this palpable curtain of doom that was just swallowing everything as it came forward. They could see the distant peaks still in sunlight popping out of existence as this dark band came toward them and then washed over them. So that's where I want to be on August 12th of 2045 is on Pikes Peak.
I'm going to mark it on my calendar. You've convinced me. David Barron is the author of American Eclipse, A Nation's Epic Race to Catch the Shadow of the Moon and Win the Glory of the World. Thank you so much for taking the time to share your story with us.
Oh, it was my pleasure, Brian.
Okay, we need to take another break. Our show is on tape today because I and other members of the Illinois Public Media team are either in Southern Illinois or on our way to Southern Illinois for the Great American Eclipse. We know many of you are heading that way as well. Tony from Champaign sent us an email, said he saw the eclipse in 2017 in Carbondale and is intending to go back to the same spot for this year. Although did say traffic was pretty rough getting back. Hopes the state police has a better grasp on the situation. We also heard from Steve in Elmwood, who had a very special eclipse experience in the Land Between the Lakes in Kentucky. Fewer than a dozen people had chosen that spot. They're doing something a little less epic this time, heading to a friend's backyard in Ohio. Coming up after the break, we're going to hear what an SIU physicist plans to be doing with her students during the eclipse. This is the 21st Show. Stay with us.